Our Curious World welcomes Adam Sinclair Greenwood to the show. Adam is the manager and proprietor of the Robin Hood Experience, the only Robin Hood tourism-centric location in all of the city of Nottingham. So let's jump straight into this conversation, and we pick up talking about Reverend Lionel Fanthorpe.
You ask a question and he just talks and talks and talks. So I'd watch for when he was lifting up his coffee to know when I could get another question in. Because that was the only thing. Oh, it was great. I was like, teenage hero just chatting to me on Skype. I thought, yeah, if I need to get these questions in, I'm going to have to wait. So I'd watch it. As this started happening, I knew I could talk.
I got a funny story about that. So I'm a member of ASAP, actually, which is what he's the president of. So...
Yeah.
In 2011, I went to a conference, actually, for ASAP, down in, like, University of Bath, and I had no idea who these people were. And there was, you know, it's like the creme de la creme of the paranormal, the unexplained, the science world. Yeah. Here, talking, doing presentations and lectures and so on. And here's little me at the time, and just like, and then I'd had a speech or a proposal or something to put out there, and then I get invited by Dave Wood, the president, to come on stage and talk, and there's, like, Lionel Fanthorpe, he's obviously stood there, and I'm like, it's like almost like starstruck. And he's just like, he shakes my hand, and I literally lose everything that's on my mind at the time. I can't think of anything. I just garble through this script that I sort of put together, and I was just like, by the end of it, I'm sure everyone was like, what the hell? But no, it's fun.
He's a lovely guy, isn't
it? It is. I just kind of know everyone, so it's quite good.
I think it's you, Mike. There was a yeah.
Oh man, it's been a fun one. So, I'm curious. You have a forest room.
I do indeed. Yes. Well, the experience is a immersive story experience. So you don't just come here to learn about Robin Hood as you would going into a museum. You come here to become part of the story. So you start at the top of the building where there's a peasant's cottage, where you meet some poor folk, and they talk about why Robin Hood is important to them, and you see little bits and pieces from their everyday life. And then you carry on down the stairs where you meet Friar Tuck in his church, and then you're taken before the Sheriff of Nottingham in his court. There's a lot of torture devices and everything as well. And then you come down to the forest where you meet Robin Hood's Maid Marian and Little John. And over there we have Herne the Hunter, the real Herne the Hunter from Robin Hood Sherwood, the TV show. So yes, it's a chance to learn by becoming part of the story.
That's interesting. That's a really interesting way of doing it, actually. So I guess, Adam, I mean, where did it kind of begin for you? What was the fascination with Robin Hood that took you on this journey?
I think it would have to start way back in childhood, really. I don't honestly remember a time that I didn't know who Robin Hood was, you know, as a character that was in stories and films, that kind of thing. But we used to have family with a holiday home in Yorkshire that they used to let other people use from time to time. So we had a couple of holidays up there. I would have been about 8 or 9, I suppose. And a couple of times on the way back, we stopped in Sherwood Forests to break the journey. And that showed me that, you know, Sherwood Forest was a real place. And I remember sort of seeing the information boards and everything about, you know, the real Robin Hood, his history, that kind of thing. And that got me fascinated, knowing that there really was some history behind this. It wasn't just a story of the likes of Cinderella or Beauty and the Beast. It was something real that had become mythologized over the years. But yeah, ever since then, I've been fascinated. And every few years, something would re-spark my interest, I suppose. It might just be a conversation I had, or it might be, yeah, there might be a documentary on television or something. And I'd get back into the investigating and digging. And around 2005, I decided to write a Robin Hood novel. So I started digging again then, and never really looked back since. So from then, it became a bit of an obsession, if you like.
quite. I think for a lot of people, I think you really resonated. You said something that really resonated with a lot of people, is that when you talk about fantastical characters like Cinderella, Beauty and the Beast, the kind of folk tales, they are, you know them to be stories and tales. And I guess Robin Hood and, say, King Arthur and Merlin kind of have that grip that there's almost like there's something very tangible about it, because that there it existed in a point in history. And then the story is quite rich. It's the tragic superhero, as it were, of the day, fighting against the oppressors via one version. Is that really what the grip of Robin Hood is? Is that you can show what exists, Robin exists?
I think it's... Well, I say a bit of both. I better unpack that a bit. It's very, very interesting to delve into the history. And yes, knowing that there is at least some truth behind these stories is wonderful. It gives them, like you say, a tangible grip. Like everyone wants to know where Camelot was, for example, things like that. We actually know where Sherwood Forest is. It's even more, there's a better grip than King Arthur even, because you can travel all around the UK, Cornwall, Wales, Glastonbury, and they're all claimed to be where the real King Arthur was from. Now, of course, you have got Robin Hood stories. You've got Robin Hood stories in Nottinghamshire. You've got Robin Hood stories in Yorkshire. In fact, the earliest ones do seem to be more Yorkshire-based. Tony will have told you there's some in Scotland. There's some down in London. So when I say it's better pinned down, maybe not from a historian's point of view, but children can, they can watch a movie. They can read a book about Robin Hood in Sherwood Forest, and then they can actually go to Sherwood Forest and say, this is historically Sherwood Forest. This is where the story I've just read is set. And that's a great experience. And in fact, I took a group of children there earlier in the week, actually, to show them around in the snow. And they had a great time. And they visited the museum before and thought it was all great. And since being here, read up on the stories and that kind of thing. But to actually be there in Sherwood Forest and say, okay, this is where we would hide. This is the road that you'd have to watch for the rich people coming along. That just made it so much more real for them. But the other side of it is, because there is so much of a mix of history and folklore in the Robin Hood stories, and I honestly think it's a mistake to try and pin down the one real Robin Hood, because so many different people's stories, real people, have fed into the legend over the centuries and mixed that in with some pre-Christian folklore as well. And you've got a really interesting, heady mix, and it almost diminishes it to try and split it out and say, okay, it was this man at this time. Because Robin Hood is bigger than that. And the great thing is he can basically be whatever you need him to be. If you need him to be a political rebel, if you need him to be a hero standing up for the poor, if you need him to be just someone who would befriend you in a tough time, you can find that element of Robin in the legends and make that your Robin.
I was going to say, and that, in that sense, do you think Robin Hood technically is like the first superhero in that sense? Because he can adapt to the characteristics required by the reader. You know, he can, like you said there, he become the hero, he can become the saviour, he can tell a story, he can fight oppression. There's lots of different elements that a reader could grip onto. And I think that works well with comic books, and like or amazing heroes from like something like Thor or Apollo or something. You can look into that and go, I can grasp at that. Do you think that's what Robin Hood's like kind of endearing quality is that he can adapt to any situation?
I think so, certainly, but more so than, I would hesitate to use the word the first superhero, because of course you just mentioned Thor and Apollo. Many of the gods of ancient legends are essentially superheroes. Very, very little difference. But the key difference there between Robin Hood and those figures is they are all bigger somehow. They are more than a mortal man. They are, they're either a god or a demigod or imbued with some kind of power whereas Robin Hood has never been portrayed as anything other than mortal. And that, well, I say never, of course, there's always stories and movies and stuff where they try and bring in elements of magic. But whereas King Arthur has taken on some very sort of qualities, a bit like the early saints, you know, given some degree of supernatural power.
Yeah, there's like a romancing, there's a bit of a history in there, but yeah, there's also these supernatural elements.
Yes, but Robin's story has never made him anything more than a mortal, and I think that's a great deal. He is a superhero, he is any of these things you need to be, but he's also you and me. Any of us could be Robin Hood. So a child reading the stories can look and say, well, that could be me. If you take even non-powered superheroes like Iron Man or Batman, they have something about them that enables them to be heroes. Like in those cases, they're both incredibly rich, so they can develop the technologies they need to do their job. Whereas Robin Hood, he's a normal man that has to make the best of the situation he finds himself in. In later stories from Elizabethan times onwards, he's a nobleman, which you could argue would have given him a higher level of education, maybe some better skills than average yeoman might have had. But in the early stories, he is a yeoman, so not a peasant. Wouldn't have been one of the poorest of the poor, but essentially, to put it in modern terms, he'd have been middle class. Would have grown up with, you know, some money, some education, but no title, no great nobility, no great amount of money to, you know, to stand to inherit anything like that. Just a normal person, and that I think is the great appeal. He's a normal man who becomes a hero when put into the situation. He's not a natural hero. He wasn't born a hero. He wasn't born into great wealth. He wasn't born with power. But when he found himself in the situation where a hero was needed, he stepped up. And I think that's the appeal.
So that helps as like an enduring legend, as it were. Because I guess the Robin Hood story has been told and retold and embellished or scaled back. Like you said there, the Elizabethan times added, you know, an extra layer of like nobility or... Do you think they needed to add those layers to keep the story relevant to pass through that time?
It's more about adapting it to the audience that are going to be watching. For example, the reason this story was changed in Elizabethan times, as best we can tell by Anthony Munday, is that his theatre audience were aristocratic. And prior to that, you'd had a story where you had a yeoman standing up to or fighting aristocrats. And Munday thought, well, if my audience come and see this and see themselves basically portrayed as the baddies, they're not going to enjoy it. So instead, he made Robin Hood a good aristocrat fighting the bad aristocrats on behalf of the common man. So the audience could then watch and go, ah, of course, if I'd been around then, I would have been like Robin, I'd have been the good aristocrat, fighting the bad and corrupt ones. And the story adapts to the audience, like you say, with the romanticising. It is really, yes, I'd say it's more an adaptation to the audience rather than keep it relevant in modern times as such. I suppose, particularly with the current movies and things like that, they do try to make the situation relatable. Because if you said something in a very accurate period history, it can be difficult to get people to care. So I think that's why some recent adaptations have gone more for sort of pseudo-historical, almost a kind of sort of once upon a time kind of setting, so that they can
embellish,
so that the audience can relate to the characters.
Interesting. You're quite right there, actually. You know, of the films that have come out from, say, the Errol Flynn ones, the Robert Greens, to, say, the more recent ones, to that recent holiday, the Jamie Foxx one, that I think I saw. you know, they are very much trying to tell something about the time, aren't they, that the film was made? Like Robin of Sherwood in the 80s and so on, when it added more characters to the ensemble of Merry Men.
Exactly. And even the 1960s Adventures of Robin Hood series, watching it now, it's difficult to realise how relevant and actually quite political it was. Because it was made largely by writers who had been blacklisted from Hollywood during the the Reds on the Bed menace idea. So it was written by writers with strong socialist leanings. And a lot of that comes across in the stories that maybe what wasn't so obvious in the early buzz. I mean, I saw a very interesting play a few years ago at the Nottingham Royal Centre Playhouse. It was called Hood, and it was the Robin Hood story, but each chapter was set in a different historical period, none of them medieval. So it started in Victorian times, then there was a World War One bit, a World War Two bit, a 1980s bit, and then a modern bit. But it was the same story with the same characters, but they just kept transplanting them into different times to move the story on. And that was interesting. It made Robin Hood very much, it put him in the context of a political socialist all through, you know, whatever the equivalent would have been at the time. And I wasn't, I don't know, there was something about it, it felt a little bit forced to a degree. It didn't quite ring true for me in that, you know, having Robin Hood as a Labour Party candidate, it seemed a little bit, I don't know, I prefer to think of Robin Hood just as someone doing what he feels in his heart to be right, rather than aligning him to any particular grander cause in any way.
So I might sound a bit odd. I don't want to veer the conversation off things. This is part's really interesting. So what do you think about, say, younger Robin Hood? What do you think as a character, as a person who lived at, say, 1190, with just what was life like for a person at that time?
Well, as you mentioned, young Robin Hood, the thing definitely comes across in the early ballads of him being headstrong and arrogant. In fact, the ballad of Robin Hood and Little John mentions him being just 20, which I think is quite significant. But nearly all the stories start with him being bored, going out, picking a fight, losing the fight, and then making friends with the person he picked a fight with. That's the majority of the Robin Hood ballads, and they all follow that kind of pattern. What life would have been like for him? As I say, he growing up, he would have been educated, most likely at home, would have been able to read and write to a reasonable degree, have some understanding of maths, that kind of thing, some understanding of history. The impression you get from the ballads is of someone who grew up quite comfortable, in a degree of what would now be called privilege, I suppose, who then finds himself out with nothing. So he goes from being quite comfortable to being someone with nothing. Although, interestingly, most of the early stories don't mention how he becomes an outlaw. They start with him as an outlaw in the forest. But he's clearly used to being a leader among men, which has led some people to think he might have had a military background. For example, I mean, the one quite strong theory that to try and place the ballads in a very specific historical window, it can be placed to the aftermath of the Lancastrian Revolt, where the yeoman archers on the losing side had no choice basically but to become outlaws in the forest. So whether those stories specifically are true about an individual man, Robin Hood, can be debated, but the historical context is certainly true in that there were yeoman archers outlawed for supporting the wrong side in the revolt and having to live out in the forest. That would match with the idea of the king coming by and pardoning him and taking him into his service, as happens at the end of the story. So there is a very real. It's a bit like people have said about some historical novels. The story might be made up, but the world in which they take place is very historically accurate.
So there's enough threads of reality, of truth, of the events and the circumstances of the time that that the story continues because we can look back at that time. Is that how you would describe that?
Not so much of a looking back at the time, but when people want to find out the truth about it, let's say compare it to another fairy tale, that they tend to take place sometime in the past with things that we know have never happened. But you just accept that. Whereas the Robin Hood story, you can look at those early ballads and you can actually pin down to within about 5 years when they must be set. Whether they actually happened or not is more of a debate, but you can tell that the author or the person that compiled them knew in their head when these stories were supposed to take place. So they're not in some kind of dream time or once upon a time. They are written as having taken place in a specific place at a specific time. And that gives them that grounding, if you like, that I think makes the Robin Hood story so enduring as well. As we were saying earlier, there are real places, there are real times, there is real history that you can pin it to, even if the story itself is an amalgam of so many different people's adventures over the years.
Yeah, because I would guess that, so like you said there's quite a few different characters who've like the Maid Marian character may have been from a different era, or maybe 100 years later, that somehow amalgamated into the story as his love interest.
Absolutely, that happens quite a lot. I mean, Maid Marian doesn't appear in the stories until the May Games in Tudor times. In the early stories, the only woman in them is the Prioress of Kirklees, who's responsible for Robin's death in the end. There's no love interest at all. When she was first introduced in the May Games, she was far more of a pantomime dame kind of character, would have been played by a large, well-built young man in comical drag with over-the-top makeup, who would go around flirting with all the men watching, that kind of thing. Very much a equivalent of the modern pantomime dame. And then it was, of course, Anthony Munday's play did have a wife for Robin Hood. But really, it was the Victorian era with their romanticisation that turned her into, I suppose, if you like, a more of a Disney princess kind of character. And as the 20th century rolled on, she's been reimagined so many times. You've got Maid Marian and her Merry Men.
Of course, that was exactly in my mind at the time. I can't remember what it was. Yeah,
Even in Robin and Sherwood, even though she's raised as a noble woman, she's a lot tougher. She has skills in herbs and medicine, that kind of thing. She's much more a member of the band in her own right.
She becomes
so from the 1980s onwards, and then of course, like I say, Maid Marian and Her Merry Men, where she's really the leader. That came from Tony Robinson watching his daughter playing with her friends and thinking, well, if she was in the outlaw band, she would definitely be the leader. She wouldn't be some mean little wallflower. So he based his version of the character on his daughter. But like I was saying about Robin Hood being able to, that you can find whatever you want in the Robin Hood story. Maid Marian is even more of a gift to writers because there is no historical basis for her at all. She's a made up character introduced into the stories later. So you don't, owe, like as a writer, you don't owe anything to a real person. And if you're writing a, even if you're writing a fictionalized version of a real person, I mean, take Hilary Mantel's series, like the Wolf Hall series, or even on Netflix, you've got The Crown. A fictionalization, but of real people. So there's a degree of responsibility in there, to try to portray that person fairly. Whereas when you come to a character like Maid Marian, she is entirely fictional. So you can create a Marian or a Marian equivalent in your story, that fits whatever you know. If you want a princess, she can be a princess. If you want a badass outlaw, she can be a badass outlaw. In fact, in my own series, I do have a character called Marian who's introduced later, but the Maid Marian equivalent character, if you like, is actually she's semi-feral, and she's the one that teaches Robin the outlaw skills.
Interesting.
So she's a much stronger character. Not because I was trying to make any kind of point or statement. It just as I was imagining the stories, that's how it played out for me. But yeah, you with Maid Marian, you've got no responsibility to any historical figure. You can make her whatever you want it to be. And I think that's wonderful for little girls who love the legend as well. It's interesting when you see them come here, they want to dress up or say, "I'm Maid Marian." Some dress as a princess, some dress as a girl Robin Hood, basically, and anything in between. So, almost more importantly than Robin Hood, then she becomes a cipher, if you like, to give a way into the stories for any girls, really, because there's so many male characters. So basically, any boy or any man can find one of the characters that they can connect to in some way. But there is only really this one girl character, but she is infinitely flexible. So whatever kind of little girl you are, you can still be Maid Marian.
That's interesting.
I think that's great.
So you say you have a series that obviously has Marion as a character, as a flexible, pliable character. So tell me a bit more about your series and what's that about?
All right. Well, I have three books. Well, three in the main series. There's a few offshoots as well.
Okay.
One
So do you
is
want to cover
very
those? What
much
is
a.
what did they come first? So did
Sorry?
those books come first? The books you mentioned there. So
As a,
those novels.
rather than first as opposed to.
Yeah, because I did one lead to the other is perhaps where I'm going with that.
Sorry, leading
Sorry,
to what? Oh, leading to the museum, you mean?
yeah.
Sorry.
So is this series a production of the novels, or is the novel a series? Maybe I've misunderstood.
Oh, sorry. Yes, I wrote one novel, very much a fantasy novel,
Okay.
and I wanted to follow it up, but it didn't. The way I'd written it didn't lend itself to any sort of actual sequel. So what I did was, because the first one was so fantasy based. With a lot of supernatural goings on and elves and goblins and all that kind of thing. I started to try and imagine, okay, who were the real people that this fantasy story is based on? And so then I started writing the series that I've yet to finish, which it has some elements of magic in it, but it's very much more realistic. I mean, I would, when people ask me what's it like, I would compare it to Game of Thrones. So there is a degree of supernatural, like some people have some slight psychic powers and that kind of thing. But it's a grittier, realer, darker world. And so yes, that's my work. Now we sell them here. So I have the one novel and then the series of novels following on.
Okay. So when you said production, I think in my head I was like, oh, a kind of a video production. So I must have misunderstood. So sorry about that.
Oh, sorry, I don't remember saying production, sorry.
No, it's okay. It's probably my fault. So, what would you like? Would you like to see your characters like embellished into flesh on a screen? How would you see that if that was to happen?
I think that would be wonderful. I've actually introduced one of the characters from my fantasy novel. I've actually introduced into the museum as a character who you meet as you walk around. So that's rather fun. If I could have my dream of my books being adapted, I would love to see a long HBO or maybe Netflix TV series. I think a film would have to cut too much out to make that. In fact, my book series, it does cover about 40 years.
Oh, okay. So
rather than trying to show that in 2 or 3 hours, I would love to see an ongoing series like Game of Thrones, based around the version of Robin Hood that I've created in those. I think it would work very well for that.
It's interesting we talk about. So people go, oh, I'd rather see it as a Netflix show. That's actually a pretty frequent statement. I've watched TV since I was a kid, but the one thing I've actually noticed, particularly about, British television dramas, is that we generally used to have very short-run shows, like, you know, 6, 8, maybe no more than 12 episodes. And that was a pretty concurrent theme, you know, whether you take, say, Life on Mars, or you take a series like, I'm trying to think, pluck one off the top of my head, Afterlife or something like that. That's a very British thing to do. And then Americans would have this really drawn-out 24-episode series. And, like, most of it is filler. That's where the English shows were much more condensed, everyone's progressed in an interesting way, and there was a much more of a flow. And it's quite remarkable to see these internet-based media distributions, whether it be Amazon and Netflix and the like, they appear to have adopted a much more British style of approach about their storytelling, yes, and their arcs. And people are listening, that works. And I think America is actually realising that, you know, these drawn-out stories where you come in at, say, episode 11, you have no idea what's going on, you can't relate to anyone, and it's almost like, oh, why am I going to continue to watch? And those particular shows in America, that those ratings are considerably very poor compared to, you know, the millions of viewers who now watch Netflix. It's quite interesting that kind of different balance.
Definitely. I've read a little bit about it. One analysis I saw pointed out that a service like Netflix doesn't have to gain advertiser revenue. So if you're making a series to be shown just on television, then you have to a degree play it safe. You can't really do anything too experimental. You can't go too dark with it. Otherwise, it has to be shown at you want to show it at 9 o'clock. There are limits to what you can put in it. Otherwise, it has to be shown at 11 when you won't get the ratings, that kind of thing. Whereas Netflix isn't chasing ratings in the same way. They want subscribers and they want viewers, but they put it out there. It's available to watch at any time. And I greatly enjoyed The Witcher,
yes,
recently, and I'm watching that. I thought if the team behind this could adapt my books, then I'm sure they would be very, very popular.
I watched The Witcher show, and having previously played through The Witcher Wild Hunt and, you know, bought Martin's books, I watched that first series and I facepalmed so hard, so much. And it's not through anything negative, I guess the show, like we're talking about Robin Hood, really, they have to really adapt it to suit its narrative or the time that it's got to run. And they took so much and they mixed it up quite a lot, because they took elements of, like, the first book and the second book, Baptism of Fire, reordered certain sequence of events, rewritten entire characters. And I was just like, what is this? This is rubbish. But then by the time
I came to it with no prior, other than knowing that the character existed. I didn't come to it with any prior knowledge. So, but more, even more than the story, the just the general sort of look and feel of the series.
Yes, and so
was what intrigued me. And Game of Thrones was a big influence on my second book when I was writing The Dark One, because I'd started it, and I was working on it, and I couldn't quite get a get a feel for it, if you like. I couldn't quite work out what it was I was trying to write, if that makes sense.
I know, it does make sense.
Then I saw the first couple of episodes of Game of Thrones. I was like, yes, this is what I'm trying to write. This is what's in my head that I couldn't quite articulate. And having seen that, I then returned to the book and I then created, yeah, if you like, Robin Hood in the style of Game of Thrones.
Because I think so, like, just touching back on The Witcher, I realised the first episode of The Witcher was very Game of Thrones-esque. I'm assuming the production team at Netflix were like, we have to make Game of Thrones, but with this universe. And then by episode two, they were like, well, we've played the game now, so no, we need to make some changes. And by episode three and four, clearly Henry Cavill had actually been playing The Witcher Wild Hunt, he'd said so, and his character was actually much more like that character. It was a bit more relaxed, as opposed to this quite stern demeanour, and he was a lot more banterful with his other characters, and he clearly became much more relaxed into the role, and the other characters appeared to do the same, and I thought it felt better episode 3 and 4.
I'll make a confession. I was 4 or 5 episodes in before I realised that there were time jumps.
Yeah, that's odd, isn't it?
I wish they would have made that a bit clearer, put some, just like a little caption or something.
Yeah, that didn't happen.
Once I realised, it was then possible to say, okay, yeah, his hair changes colour. That's actually the same. That old man is actually the boy that we met before. Okay,
yeah.
But I hadn't picked that up. So,
I did think that just. I think their writing wasn't very good for the show, but yeah, I would recommend you go play Witcher the Wild Hunt. That was very good. And I also think, look back at the books. The books are much darker. Actually, this kind of Polish folklore where everyone's trying to survive in this time, but there's all these fantastical elements going on. It's really quite
Dark. They haven't been translated very well, from what I heard.
No, not so well.
Yeah. But if I could read them in Polish, probably they'd be awesome, but...
No, Polish is a hard language to read, but they probably say that again about English, so... So if you could have someone play as your Robin Hood, then who would it be if that was to go ahead?
Oh, it would have to be, you know, different actors at different times in his life, I suppose. And when I was writing early on, I was picturing Adrian Paul from Highlander, but then I was picturing Adrian Paul off 20 years ago. Other times I thought Ben Barnes would make a good for the younger version of the character, certainly. He was in Prince Caspian and Dorian Gray.
Yes.
Really, I think though it would benefit from not having a particularly famous name. I mean, you'd have names as secondary characters, maybe. You know, someone playing the sheriff or something like that. But I would really want people to get to know my Robin Hood as Robin Hood. And I think if I may compare it to another side obsession of mine, that was a slight problem I always had with Peter Capaldi as the Doctor, because he is so well known. And it was hard for me. I mean, I know everyone else had been in other things as well. You know, you can find things that Jodie Whittaker's been in. There were things that David Tennant was in before, things that Matt Smith was in before. But with all of those, because, yeah, I didn't know them, I could just believe I was watching the Doctor.
Okay.
Whereas, because Peter Capaldi was, to me anyway, so well known and been in so much, been around for so long, I was seeing Peter Capaldi playing the Doctor.
I got you.
Rather than, so, if my books were adapted like that, I would like a relatively unknown actor to take the role, so that people would just be watching and see the character, rather than, oh, that's the chap from Star Wars playing Robin Hood now. Yeah,
I think most people still think of the thick of it first before.
Well, yeah, quite, but yeah. So I'd want someone that wasn't too well recognised, I think.
So Doctor Who, then, do you have a favourite Doctor?
Matt Smith, without a doubt.
Oh, you do? So that's interesting. So I'm still towards Paul McGann, because I listen to so much audio.
He's high up there on my list. I mean, there's none that I actually don't like, but I mean, Sylvester McCoy was my childhood Doctor, so I'm always going to have a a soft spot for him. And but the one that I, we were talking earlier about connecting to characters like Robin Hood, the one that I felt most connected to, that I could see most of myself in, is Matt Smith's Doctor. So he's the one that will always be the Doctor for me.
That's interesting. Yeah, I've actually going. I recently took out a subscription with BritBox, so I'm going through a lot of the older Doctors, and I'm enjoying some of the animations of what they've restored from the William Hartnell and the David Patrick.
Oh yes, yes, they've all been done. Yeah, era,
so they've been really good. So it's interesting just to kind of show the partner like some snippets of the Doctor's older stories and how the story narrative structure is really different, because of course it's generally 4 episodes or even 10 episodes in some regard, and how they had to tell up and down narratives as opposed to, you know, a continuous arc of a show. So storytelling is different, the way that the presentation of the characters is very different. And I guess as a child, I mean, I can remember watching Doctor Who on BBC Two in the mornings, and I saw John Pertwee's Doctor first, I think.
And, yeah, so these two are Sunday mornings, I think, didn't they?
That's right, yeah. So that was the kind of the first childhood Doctor I saw. And then I didn't really see Doctor Who again until Sylvester McCoy. And then obviously when the reboot happened, that's kind of when my kind of passion for the show and the characters kind of took off a lot more. And then I discovered Big Finish, and then I just kind of been following Paul McGann as kind of my Doctor. So it's interesting to see how the stories have changed. You know, it's technically the Doctor and an assistant or a couple of assistants. And you drop them into whatever scenario you want, historical or fantastical, or you're more down to earth. But the story is two central characters, and you can put them into any spot in time and space. I think that's a really powerful driver of a narrative. I think with the bigger casts, with like the ensemble that they have at the moment with the fam, I think that's too many characters, that the scenario and the place that they're in, they can't tell as many stories because there's then too many characters. So I think
you're right to a degree. You got too much of a personal story to follow. I know we're drifting off topic a little bit.
No, but
the mistake I think has been made with the most recent series. I mean, I love Jodie Whittaker's Doctor. And I actually love all the characters, especially Ryan and his granddad.
I think they're the only characters that actually have a story arc. Actually,
yeah, but the problem I've had with some of the episodes is that I feel they should have been happy just to do history episodes, like they used to do back in the classic show. There was some where the Doctor would just go and visit the Aztecs or cavemen or meet a king or queen or something, and there didn't necessarily have to be that sci-fi element other than the means by which they got there. And there's been a couple in the recent series. The one about the division of India and the creation of India and Pakistan, mm-hmm. and then the one about Rosa Parks. I think those would have been much stronger elements if they just let them be about the history, because that bit was really good. But they felt they had to shoehorn an alien threat. I mean, in the India one, it turned out that the aliens were just there to watch anyway. So they didn't actually impact the story in any way other than to create all those aliens. And then the racist time traveler in the Rosa Parks one, that didn't really... I'd much rather just plonk the characters into that situation and have them explore that real bit of history without trying to shoehorn an additional sci-fi element in. So I hope that's something that gets learned going forwards, because you have some great historical stories. They don't all have to have an alien in them.
Sometimes the most, like for instance in say David Tennant, even Christopher Eccleston's era, the fact that there was a lifetime here that was happening, you know, to Rose's mother.
Yes,
she existed as us in a contemporary sense. Of what happens when a time traveler leaves, comes back a year later, and the panic that this woman has gone through. But for the characters we've been following, it's like, well, it's just another day. I actually really liked that element, the fact that there was a panic and there was a worry and concern for these contemporary characters feeling, you know, loss or sadness or missing people.
Well, remember, it was season 4 before they actually went to another planet at all.
Yeah.
All the other stories were... They either took place on Earth in a different time, or in a spaceship maybe. But Planet of the Ood is the first time that they actually go to another planet. And then from season 5 onwards, when Stephen Moffat took over, it became far more going out here, there, and everywhere to different. But there's a noticeable difference between the Ross T. Davis era and the Moffat era. The Ross T. Davis era feels very much set in our world, and stuff happening sort of like under the radar, but in our world. Whereas the Stephen Moffat era onwards feels like it takes place in its own universe that isn't. Is it like even when they're on Earth, it's not our Earth. It's a different Earth. And I say I love those stories and I love that Doctor, but it's interesting to compare. They really do feel like they take place in different universes.
Interesting. So how many times has Doctor Who dipped into the world of Robin Hood?
Well, I don't know about whether it's come up in audio, but certainly Peter Capaldi's first season. They met, and that was a fun one because he insisted Robin Hood wasn't real, that it was a myth. And of course, then he meets Robin Hood, and he's trying to work out how this can be. And he's talking, you know, is he a waxwork? Is he a robot? Is he an alien? Yeah, but it turns out no, he really is Robin Hood. So the Doctor ends up with a slight egg on his face there. It's not the best episode, I have to admit. It has a lot of heart to it, though. There's a lot to love about it, but there's also a lot to cringe out about it. This has never been officially confirmed, but it's pretty clear watching it that it was written for Matt Smith. I think you're always going to have that problem with any new Doctor's first season, that the writers don't know that Doctor yet. They haven't got to know them. So there's always going to be a little bit touch and go. But again, Matt Smith left it a year earlier than he'd originally said he was going to. I think he got offered a theatre contract or something like that. I can't remember the exact circumstances. But he was supposed to do one more season. So I think a lot of the Capaldi's first stories were written, or at least first drafted.
Well, I can imagine the drafts are with the 11th Doctor. Produced a year ahead, aren't they, almost, I guess?
Yeah. So it feels a little bit odd, but there are some really lovely elements to it. And of course, Patrick Troughton played Robin Hood on television in a series in the 50s. Yes. In fact, they reference that in the... I think it was the first television Robin Hood as an ongoing series prior to the Richard Green one. But in the episode where the Doctor meets Robin Hood, he starts showing Robin Hood all the folklore that's come later. One of the pictures that flashes up on the TARDIS screen is Patrick Troughton as Robin Hood.
Oh, awesome.
So that's a fun little Easter egg there.
I think those things have to happen when there's a TV show with a bit of passion on a history. It's like, oh, well, we can look back at our own history and point and say hello, and the fans all like mark out, and it's good fun.
Yeah, exactly. And I think it's a shame in the sense that they didn't have when the BBC had their series, it would have been fun to cross over at that point.
Yeah, because that particular Doctor, we're talking about the Jonas Armstrong show, right?
Yes, that's right. Yeah.
So I think that was watchable in the sense that if you could, it felt very much like the Merlin-esque show. You know, there was some supernatural elements in there, and you could almost like, because over the year that's what they did, wasn't it? There was Merlin and Doctor Who, then the opposite year.
Exactly. It was referred to as the Doctor Who slot.
Yeah.
So you find time to fill it. To me, that show is one of the great lost opportunities in Robin Hood media history. You mentioned it to a lot of people, like, oh, that show's rubbish, rubbish, rubbish. It's like, how much of it did you watch? Oh, watched the first couple, couldn't watch it after that. Now, I mean, I gave up watching partway through the first season, I'll admit. I have since been back and watched it and enjoyed it. And I watched one or two episodes of Series 2. And then came Series 3, which has a very, very different tone.
Yeah.
It's almost an entirely different show. And in that season, they introduced this brother and sister characters, Archer. I can't remember what her name is, but she takes on the Maid Marian role because Marian was killed at the end of Season 2.
That's right, yeah.
But she takes on the Marian-esque role. And this other chap is a bit of a sort of cheeky chappy chancer. And I would have loved to see the series continue with him as Robin Hood. Because they set up right from the beginning that while Robin of Locksley is the figurehead, they always said, yeah, they're battlers, we are Robin Hood. Robin Hood is more than just the man. And even as Robin's dying, he says, find someone else to lead you. So they could very well have introduced, in fact, it seemed like it was very clearly set up for Archer to become the new Robin Hood. And then you would have had an interesting dynamic where the Robin and Marian characters were brother and sister rather than a couple. And so you could have had more sort of the banter and the way they bounce off each other would have been quite different. And I think it's a real, real shame that the show stopped just as it was finding its feet, basically.
I think you find a lot of shows like that, don't they? they get to that point where the interest is actually really there, but then by that point the seeds have already sown for no, we don't like this. We're gonna end this. So.
Exactly, it's a real shame. I'd love if someone else would pick it up, and you know, whether doing it on BBC Three or make as an audio or something. I think there's a lot of potential there. The other thing that I really liked about that series, right from the first season onwards, was the way they showed that Robin Hood was a bit of a glory hound, and that Marian had actually, in effect, been doing the Robin Hood thing for years while he was off on the Crusades. But just on the down low and undercover as the Night Watchman, this character is introduced. And I thought that was a fun little element. But yeah, when in Series 2 they said a major character was going to die, a lot of us thought that it would be Robin that died, and that someone else, possibly Alan the Dale, would become the new Robin Hood, following the Robin of Sherwood model. Well, of course, Robin of Locksley dies at the end of Season 2, and Robin of Huntingdon becomes Robin Hood. So there's a definite precedent for that. And given that they'd gone all the way through with the We Are Robin Hood thing, that's what a lot of us were expecting. But in the end, it was Marian that died. But then that death, it didn't... In some older series, I mean, Robin Sherwood, I'm afraid, is a particularly egregious one of these. Because back then, like, series weren't designed to be watched over and over again, people tended to move on a bit too quickly from, like, a character would die, they'd be replaced, and everyone would just carry on as normal. But I liked that in Season 3 of Robin Hood, not only did Marian's death affect Robin, but it greatly affected Guy Gisborne as well, you know, who had genuinely been in love with her, but also was the one that killed her. So I liked that did have an impact. Even when they brought back Keith Allen's campy sheriff, he fitted he was woven into the darker tone of the season as well. So yeah, when people ask me what I think of it, I say I absolutely love Season 3. The rest is... It's fun. But what amuses me now is I think that show is quite recent. You know, to me, it's still... and then I get people come to the museum, adults with little children, saying, oh, I watched that one when I was a kid. And I think, oh, no, of course you did. It makes me feel very old.
So when was that? Was that like... 2012-ish?
No, it was 2006 it started.
Oh, wow. So it really is quite a while ago now.
So it is a very, very long time ago. So yeah, that's when you think about it, it is a very long time ago now. But it, I suppose because it's the most recent one that's been on telly, it and it's on iPlayer quite a lot. It doesn't feel that old. I've tried to contact people to see if I can get hold of any of the props or anything like that, but there doesn't seem to be anything available. What's interesting though is the costume that Robin Hood wears in Doctor Who is a green version of the brown one that Jonas Armstrong wears in season 3 of Robin Hood.
I actually might have to go back and see
if have a look. So his is brown, and so I don't know whether it's the same one that they just recoloured or whether they got them in, because Gisborne and the Sheriff actually wear a very similar outfit. It's like they got a job lot of these leather.
I'm sure the BBC do, It's just like, that's warehouses and stock lines.
So when I saw the first advanced photos of what Robin Hood was going to look like, I thought, well, that's the TV series costume, just green, not brown.
So Robin Hood being off telly, as it were. So, I mean, how long do you think there was between the major kind of TV shows that existed in the past? Is it about 10 to 12 years between each of those shows?
Probably longer, I would say. I mean, it depends. Not all. I mean, there's more than people realise, and they don't all enter the public consciousness in the same way. Because in the 90s, I mean, in the early 80s, you had Robin Hood Sherwood. And then in the 90s, there was a series called The New Adventures of Robin Hood. Yes. That was very much in the style of Hercules or Zena.
Yeah, I can remember that, yeah.
One of those. And I think it got shown on Channel 5, at 5 o'clock in the afternoon, that kind of thing. But it was entertaining fluff. And it had some interesting guest stars. I think Christopher Lee was in an episode of it. And Robert Addy, who played Guy Gisborne in Robin Sherwood, he had a one episode cameo in that series. So it's another one that isn't as bad as people remember it being. But it was very much of its time, very much in the Hercules or Xena.
Yeah.
Mold. So that one didn't really have much of an impact. I mean, there's a CGI animated series now. I don't know if it actually gets shown anywhere, whether it's just a web series, but I think it's originally German and got dubbed into English. Or there might be two different ones, but that's Robin Hood and the gang as, I mean, they're outlaws and they're still doing the Robin Hood thing, but they're children. So that's around. That's what some children know now.
I would guess.
I don't know. There's certainly. Sorry.
I was going to say. I kind of guess that if there's a kind of relative, almost expected period of time between each of them, I suspect that a television production company has already picked up, to run another series at some point.
Yeah, I mean, there's certainly more films than there are TV shows.
Yeah.
The films tend to come out at least every 10 years, often. Yeah, the big ones that try and make a big splash. Which is why I think, it doesn't necessarily have to be mine, but to create an HBO style series, I think would be the next logical thing to try with the character. Of course, the Robin Hood character and the generic stories, they're completely public domain. So it's different if you were going to adapt Angus Donald's Outlaw series, Outlaw Chronicles, then yes, obviously there's royalties that they're involved. But anyone can make a Robin Hood TV show or series. That's where some issues start coming in that people start assuming. I mean, actually, it's one of my dreams to see my original characters start popping up in generic Robin Hood stories. And that people have just accepted them as part of the mythology. There's a story that when Prince of Thieves was being written, the writer included a Saracen character called Nazir. Having seen Robin Silvers and just assuming that, that character was part of the general folklore. And then Richard Carpenter approached him and said, well, actually, Nazir is my original character. I didn't... I invented that character for Robin of Sherwood. So they changed to a Moorish Saracen called Azim. But Since then, it's kind of become a, even the BBC series, I think they did it first, but then later they introduced a Muslim married man.
That's right, yeah.
But except it was a woman called known as John. But that, and then of course in the Jamie Foxx one, they combine the little John character with, you know, with Morgan Freeman's Azeem, and create a kind of, I mean, he basically he's credited as Little John. He plays Azeem basically, and takes the name John because the English people can't pronounce his Saracen name so well. So little elements like that do become standard tropes, if you like. But now it is a standard trope to include a Muslim married man. And that trope simply didn't exist before the 80s. So the story continually grows and develops like that.
You know what I always thought was really interesting, and I kind of really liked it at the same time, is that so every time one of these major productions came out, there was also a kind of a lesser, bigger production one that actually was a bit more grounded.
Yes, that's true. I mean, there's Robin Hood the Rebellion that came out at the same time as the Tyrone Edgerton one. I think there's a degree of cynicism there with a kind of mockbuster, if you like. Yeah, there's going to be a big one, so you can ride the coattails a little bit. But I also think it's probably easier for smaller production companies to get their movie distributed, if you like, because Robin Hood the Rebellion, it's good, but it's a little bit dull, honestly, was my verdict on it. You can see some clear Game of Thrones influences in there, in that Maid Marian is Arya Stark, basically, completely. I must admit, the thing that got me about that movie was the four male leads all looked so ridiculously alike that if you weren't paying very close attention, you weren't sure which character was which half the time.
So basically it's men like us with beards.
Yeah. They all had sort of short, dark, curly hair and a youthful beard. I'm like, well, I can't actually tell you apart. None of them were interesting enough. But I do think that a smaller production has more chance of getting distribution, which is the big thing.
Yeah.
If there's a big Hollywood production coming as well, because either a DVD distributor or Netflix or something like that will take a punt on it because they know there's going to be, or they hope there's going to be interest. I mean, a few years earlier you had Ghosts of Sherwood, which I actually love. I mean, it's one of those so bad it's good ones.
Yeah.
Have you seen it?
I'm trying to think of the one that came out that alongside Prince of Thieves that I actually really enjoyed.
Patrick Bergen, yes. Again, just called Robin Hood. That was a British production, I think. Again, very, very closely based on the ballads, and their portrayal of Maid Marian, played by Uma Thurman, is quite close to the stories in which she starts appearing, where she disguises as a boy and fights Robin, and Robin doesn't know who she is at first, that kind of thing. So yes, it's arguably the better is a difficult word, isn't it? It's the more true to the early stories version.
Yeah.
But again, a bit like Robin Hood the Rebellion, it just isn't as exciting. It's never going to Prince of Thieves appeals to the 10-year-old boy in all of us, I think. It's swashbuckling high adventure. And it is silly and it's daft and it's very Hollywood, but it's so much fun. Like Pirates of the Caribbean. Whereas these other ones, they're far more serious, far more kind of like earnest, if you like. In a sense, they're more deserving. Like they deserve to be the more successful one, but they're just not. they don't have that level of swashbuckling excitement that is going to capture the audiences in the way that a movie like Prince of Thieves would.
You've probably been involved with it yourself. Is it the Maze, of course, every year would do their annual show of Prince of Thieves, and everyone would bring mead, and there'd be a big celebration. Everyone would sing along with the songs and stuff. Did you go to that?
I've not. I keep missing it. It keeps coinciding with other things, but it is something on my list to do for sure. But that just shows you it's the fact that people can sort of lip sync the whole movie.
Yeah.
Even if they haven't seen it in a few years, it just something was just capture the public imagination in a way that others just don't. And if it brings people to the legend, and this is what I said when the Tony Anderson one came out, which actually I enjoyed a whole lot more than I expected to. I went to see it with the team from here actually, and we went with low expectations. But if you divorce it from any historical context, if you treat it like it is Game of Thrones or something that takes place in its own world, it just happens to be called England. Yeah, the city happens to be called Nottingham. It's actually a great, fun movie, and I think it's a real shame that it didn't become the franchise it was designed to. But it historically it's cringingly awful. Like you have the Crusades taking place in Arabia, you have the church appointing the sheriff. And quite apart from any of the I can sort of overlook the pseudo-modern costumes, but just the awfully wrong historical information was. But if you can look past that and just enjoy it as a movie, then it's going to be quite a lot of fun. I'm trying to think where was I going with this? Oh yes, that was it. So anyway, when the movie was coming out, you can imagine I got interviewed quite a few times for various blogs and things like that. As from Robin Hood, so what do you think about it? And my thought was and remains, and it will be the same for the next one and the one after that. If someone enjoys if someone goes and sees the movie, and it gets them interested in the story, in the legend, in the character, and they want to find out more, and it sets them off, watching other films or reading the early ballads, digging through the history, then the movie has done its job. The movie was a success as far as I'm concerned. And I don't care how inaccurate or clunky the movie was. If the movie captured someone's interest and turned them on to the story of Robin Hood as something they wanted to find out more about, then I'm more than happy.
Yeah, that's a fair point, really, isn't it? So it did its job. More people are interested in it, and they'll probably go buy the home version. They'll keep it for their family. They'll share it with friends, and the story, the legend continues, as they say.
Exactly.
So I'm actually really curious about your the Robin Hood experience itself, because you mentioned earlier you panned the camera around at your location. So tell me about how you got that started.
Right, well, it was actually started by someone else, a local entrepreneur. His name was David. It was an oddly evolving idea. On a trip to Ireland, he saw a whiskey museum, thought Nottingham has a tradition of beer making, and decided he wanted to open a beer museum. And then had a thought, since it's in Nottingham, maybe it should have a Robin Hood element to it. As in having Robin Hood characters recording the information and that kind of thing. And he approached a friend of mine who has a small production company about making videos. And this friend put him on to me, and he ended up hiring me basically to build it and run it. And then after the first year, he's someone who likes to set things up and move on.
Okay.
Yeah, he's not generally in anything for the long term. He gets excited by new projects. Yeah. So at the end of the first year, he was done with it. And I had so many ideas about what what more should be invested in, what more should be done. Because again, he'd been approaching it, well, there's anything wrong with this, but he'd been approaching it with a businessman's eye, you know, in terms of, you know, making a lot of money without having put too much into it in the first place. Whereas I was approaching it as someone with a passion. So we came to an arrangement, and I took it over, and I've owned it ever since. So for the last 3 and a bit years, it's been mine. So I've been constantly improving, constantly adding new bits, constantly adding new elements. I mean, even this week I've got a new figure that I need to do up and put in. It'll never ever be finished, as far as I'm concerned. I'm always looking to improve and add stuff, and I try and listen to what people say and try to put. I mean, I've got dreams of what I would love to do, with animatronics and video walls and that kind of thing. At the moment, that's beyond my resources, but who knows? Maybe one day. I mean, what I'd love is a company like Merlin to come along and give me a more suitable building for start, and say, look, you know, we love what you've done with Next to Nothing. Yeah, here's 50,000. See what you can create. Because really, we've been so lucky with this building that we have a very landlord that loves having us here, very supportive of us, very very keen to help us out. But it is an old house, so there's a lot of stairs, and each set piece is in a different room, which works, but it does limit the accessibility, does limit what you can do with the space, because it's kind of defined by, here is a room. So you can't really have two. There's other bits of the story I'd love to put in, but where would I put them at the moment? Yeah. Unless you start building false walls inside the rooms and dividing them, that gets tricky. So the ideal space for something like this would really be like a warehouse or something, or an old church, where you've got a big, like a large empty space that you create not a maze in that you can get lost in, but you create a walkthrough that you follow the story along. That's what I'd love to do. Maybe get my hands on an old church
I mean, we have Nottingham. I think I said this to you on the message, is that despite the fact that Nottingham is a city of legends, it's our iconic character, the whole world knows it, there's nothing here about Robin Hood at all. Which is
absolutely, we're completely independent. We get we're not in any way, connected to the city. If you like, we have to fight for any kind of publicity or recognition that we do get. Tales of Robin Hood's the same. People come and they reminisce about it, and they assume it was run by the city. Like, well, why did they close it? But no, again, it was another private business. It's almost got to conspiracy theory levels with me wondering, why doesn't the city want to be associated with Robin Hood? I honestly can't work it out. I mean, we've got the statue. There will be references in the castle when it's there. We've got the painting in the council house, and of course, they sell Robin Hood hats and things like that. And if there's a major parade or anything like that, my good friend Tim gets asked to be Robin Hood in that. And of course, you've got Aid, who does his very very well regarded history walks in the character of Robin Hood. But again, he's an independent private business. So there's a lot of passion out there for Robin Hood, but the city doesn't seem interested. I mean, you can contrast it with a town like Hamelin in Germany, or Hemel, where the Pied Piper legend is associated with. It's almost like, I mean, it's a real working town where people live and there's businesses and everything, but it's almost like entering a zone of Disneyland, the Pied Piper land. It's everywhere. Everything is either the Piper or rats. And over the summer, they do a play every Sunday that all the families in the town get involved with. They have a team of five Pied Pipers doing walks, all in the same costume, all organized doing walks around the city, twice a day. And yes, they've really embraced that this is the home of the Pied Piper story. And then you come back to Nottingham and you sort of look at it. And I remember someone coming once, they went around here, they came and oh, that was great. So what other Robin Hood stuff is there to do?
Nothing.
Well, you've done it. Sorry.
It's bizarre, isn't it? I guess a couple of years ago they opened the Robin Hood Visitor Centre up in Sherwood. Edwinstowe, rather. And there's nothing here. Is it a conspiracy that the council doesn't want to promote effectively a brand that it doesn't have to sell? It's
bizarre. I mean, that certainly around the millennium, I've heard that the people in the council actually said, we want to distance ourselves from Robin Hood because he was a criminal and was against taxes, and we don't think that's a good. the council did associated with and facepalmed at that, but even since, so it really does make me wonder sometimes. You know, what do they know that the rest of us don't? You know, why? And of course, you've got the Yorkshire connection as well. And you'd think that Yorkshire would say, "Well, Nottingham doesn't want him; we'll have him." But they don't seem to want him either. So you know. What is going on? I really have to ask. Now, the Sheriff Forest Visitor Centre, I actually have quite a great deal of sympathy for the RSPB in this situation. They're coming for a lot of flack for basically, not doing enough about Robin Hood. But I don't know how many people realise how this all came about.
Okay.
When the council were looking to offload Sherwood Forest, in effect. I mean, they still own it, but they want to offload the management of it. A deal was struck whereby the RSPB would take over the woodland management and the environmental aspect of it, because it is a site of scientific interest. It's a beautiful place for nature. They have long-eared bats. There's all sorts of endangered species there as well. So the RSPB were going to take over the that side of things. We're going to have a little visitor centre where the new one is, which was dedicated to nature and ecology and the preservation of that kind of thing. And then on the other side of the road, over a bridge or under a tunnel, depending on how they did it, where there's now just a big bit of scrubland, there was going to be a huge Disney or Merlin-style Robin Hood attraction. With the medieval village, castle, the hog roasts, all the stuff that people, would come to Sherwood Forest expecting to find. That was going to be over there. Multi-million pounds, theme park, basically, based solely around Robin Hood and the Robin Hood stories. And for one reason or another, that fell through. So suddenly the RSPB were left having to cover everything. Mm-hmm. And they hadn't actually, they hadn't bargained on having to do the Robin Hood bit. So they've been left, holding this baby and struggling to keep up. Now, one of my dreams is to have three branches of the Robin Hood experience, one in Nottingham, one in Edwinstowe or close by, and one in Yorkshire, where a lot of the early bards are based. And they would have a different flavour. It wouldn't just be recreating the same one. I mean, certainly in Yorkshire, I would focus on the Yorkshire elements of the stories, for example. And I mean, I really love to be able to do that in collaboration with the RSPB if they find that they're not in a position to cover the Robin Hood bit, if you like. I would love to be able to go and maybe do that somehow in collaboration with them.
Have you approached them to ask that?
We have approached them about doing events together and things like that. We did attend the Robin Hood Festival unofficially a couple of years ago. But gradually I've been getting to know the staff there and trying to build a relationship there so that when funding and such like does become available, that we could maybe look at a collaboration there.
Because I would think right now that the government is, I don't know what their financial situation is, but I'm assuming they would want to encourage, the local councils to boost their tourism greatly. And you think there would be fun?
I think everyone's afraid to spend money at the moment. I was talking to a bunch of other friends in the entertainment industry a few nights ago, and they're saying this lockdown had a very different feel to the one at the start of the year. At the start of the year, people were still booking things for later in the year. I mean, we had to hear people come and say, "Oh, yeah, I was booked to come for an evening event. You know, can we move it to October?" That kind of thing. And a lot of entertainment groups were coming up with sort of COVID-safe shows that they could do, so that the parades and the outdoor festivals and stuff could still go ahead. But this time, people are just very demoralised, and everything's getting cancelled, and they're not even booking for later in the year. They don't want to try putting on the COVID safe shows. I mean, a lot of my friends, they put a lot of effort into coming up with these, you know, comedy characters and things that they can do that would be perfectly safe. But we found here over the summer, when we could open, it was nothing like the footfall that we would normally get. So I think especially councils are concerned about putting on an event because they're worried that no one will come. Even if you make the event perfectly COVID safe and perfectly safe to attend, there's the big worry that it just won't be attended in sufficient numbers to justify what was spent on it.
I think that's really powerful.
It's horrible. I mean, we tried opening. I mean, at the moment we can't be open because we're in tier three, but we could technically open the gift shop. We've tried for a few days. We tried over the weekend, and not one person came in. People were, when you see the crowds down at the square, but no one was coming up here. It's a really, really tough time for everyone. And again, when I got the first grant, the majority of it was pumped into improving the experience, on the logic that we'll be able to reopen, we'll be able to, you know, people will see how much better it is, well, you know, people will come, we'll have a good year from then on. It's wise to invest this money in the business. And that just hasn't played out. So now, yeah, I'm afraid to spend, and the councils are even more so. So I mean, I don't want to end the conversation on a bleak note, but everyone has gone into sort of very, very frugal mode, because we just don't know when the business is going to pick up again. Even if, you know, the tiers were, you know, COVID was eradicated tomorrow, it's pushed everyone so far back. It will take, I'm sure it's going to be another couple of years before we're back to where we would have been without it.
Yeah, that's right. I think the devastating effect that it's had on businesses, entertainment, the kind of the whole hospitality industry, the customer service industry, the things you can do with your excess cash, really, those businesses have nearly all dried up, and some would say.
Yeah, I mean, that's the problem. Certainly, again, the first lockdown, it all felt more optimistic. It's like, it was frustrating that we couldn't be open, we were missing it, but there was a feeling that, oh, well, you know, things will get better, we'll be able to open it, and everyone was, you know, being supported, seeing, you know, all the schemes and everything, and now businesses are just closing. I mean, it'd be the question of, you know, when things are allowed to be open again, what will be left to reopen?
Yeah, it's odd that you say that, but about a year ago.
And the pubs and the hotels, a lot of them are closing their doors forever.
Yeah.
So you're either going to have a bunch of people, either, you know, lots of loans to start businesses from scratch, or people trying to revive old. But yeah, by the time this is all over, so much will have been lost, and I don't know if we're ever going to get it back, because the world will be different.
Very much so. I was just going to say that I was in Sheffield a few years ago. I was attending a gig there at the arena, and me and my son, we went through Sheffield City Centre, and even then, I would say maybe 80% was closed shutters. everywhere, even in the middle of the day.
There was someone on Radio 4, I think, a couple of days ago, saying, yes, this isn't completely out of the blue. The stuff that's happening is the way things were going. But COVID has accelerated it. So things that we might have been seeing sort of over the next 5 years, we're seeing now. Yeah, when you got big chains like, is it Debenhams and...
Yeah, that's right. Burns of, the Arcadia is gone, yeah, so...
Yeah, if they can't survive, how possibly can small businesses? And the other thing is, when people get used to not coming out, I mean, there's plenty of empty shops, and say the council said, okay, we're going to make them rent-free for the first year or something like that. If people are out of the habit of coming out to an area, they're really not going to start again. And that was the main concern that people were saying about the likes of Debenhams, the big department stores, closing down. People would come to a destination shop like that and then, while they were there, look in the smaller shops and things like that.
That's right.
But if the big draw isn't there, then they're not going to come out. So there's going to be a knock-on effect for all the smaller ones. So if city centres are to survive in any way resembling how they have been, there's going to need to be something that makes people want to come to them.
Yeah.
And then other smaller businesses can benefit from that. But something's got to get you there in the first place. Because if you can sort everything online, so why would you bother going out? Up in London, people like to go out to see the, particularly this time of year, to see the lights, to see the Christmas displays. That was a childhood ritual of mine, you know, going up to Regent Street and Oxford Street.
Yeah, I saw the pictures there, like, from Saturday. Yeah. It's like, geez.
Yeah, looking Hamleys and everything like that. But there's fewer and fewer shops like, you know. I remember as a teenager, you'd have the big Virgin Megastores, the big Tower Records and stuff like that. And you would go there because you'd find stuff there that you couldn't find other places. And, yeah, that's all drifting away. And, yeah, I know a lot of pubs won't be able to reopen. A lot of shops are closing forever. Museums like mine are really going to struggle. And so I'm utterly indebted to my landlord for being so understanding and saying, look, you know, pay me what you can when you can. I'm not going to, you know, be too difficult about it. But if I was in any sort of a more, like if I was down in the city centre or something where the rents are astronomical. I mean, that's the other ridiculous thing. Buildings are sitting empty.
Yeah.
Because the rents are unaffordable. It's like, well, surely you'd do better to have some income.
Rather than no income. I'll tell you a story, though. So, you know when the Victoria Centre had its big overhaul and they redid the food court again and they opened all them shops up at the front where McDonald's is now? So, I was filming with my camera a bit of a documentary stuff about... Because there was a whole point of time where a lot of them shops just closed because clearly it just costs too much. There was a particular restaurant that is where the big McDonald's is now and it was called, like, Coast to Coast or something. And it looked very nice inside. It clearly cost far too much. Very much like an American kind of lounge bar. And so when that shop had closed, I'd walked past and I had my phone with me. And it said the rent on the door was $450,000 per annum. And I was like, what? It's like, you wonder why no restaurants can open here. Aware that on the opposite side to that, there was a place called, it was like a gourmet burger place. It was really quite nice. And the rent for that was $295,000 a year. And you wonder why Intu is just like, they clearly overestimated how much they were selling these buildings for. It wasn't profitable. And it's just like...
Yeah, it's crazy. How can any... I've looked at a few empty properties down near the town centre in the past. And even a fairly modest ground floor shop, it's like $5,000 a month. Yes. I was like, I, I will not. Who will make that kind of money?
Yeah, I'm sure McDonald's might, but there's not many other places.
To be able to put. But anyway, I mean, I'm conscious that we've been talking about an hour and a half now. It looks like my battery's starting to run a little bit low. So
let's make this a bit more. Let's bring this a bit more upbeat then. So we don't want to take it in the COVID dark level. So if people wanted to know more about the Robin Hood experience, how can they contact you? And
okay, the absolute best way to contact us is through our Facebook page, Robin Hood Experience. You know, we're quite easy to find, and that's where we put all the up-to-date information, all the pictures, everything like that. We also have a TripAdvisor page. You'll be able to find us on there. But yeah, the Facebook page is definitely the best way of getting in touch. We love hearing from people. We love seeing people's photos from when they visited. And yeah, we very much look forward to welcoming people again when we can.
So I guess the other question would be, is it, say, in relation to how Nottingham looks geographically, where is the Robin Hood experience, and
very close to Nottingham Castle, so that's the best landmark to find us. So if you're walking up from the city centre, you'll pass us before you get to the castle on Friar Lane. So you go past the beer killer, across the main Marion Way, keep going up, you'll find us there on the right. If you're coming up the other way, so if you're parked out of town, you're coming up past the trip to Jerusalem and past the statue, come up to the castle, and just sort of start heading down the hill past the Crafty Crow, and you'll find us there. On days when we're open, we're outside that you can take photos in, so that's a good thing to look out for to spot us. So yeah, we're at the top of Fly Lane, very close to Nottingham Castle.
Okay.
And of course, we're very much looking forward to them opening up again early next year. We've been in talks with them to collaborate to an extent as well, which is going to be good for everyone, definitely.
Fantastic. Adam, that's been wonderful to share a conversation with you, and I hope many people will get in contact with you and want to learn more about it. It's been a fun conversation. I guess we've gone from history, your history, Doctor Who, COVID, everywhere in between, so it's been good fun.
Well, it's been a great pleasure spending this morning with you and getting to talk about all these different things. I'm more than happy to talk to anyone else who wants to get in touch. Say we're closed at the moment, but I am here. As you can see, we're here in the Sherwood Forest, so I can be here, happy to do any interviews, happy to talk to anyone. And you know, if anyone's looking to do Robin Hood related projects in the future, do get in touch. So you've got Robin Hood, we've got Little John. We can definitely be a part of that for you as well.
That's fantastic. So.